Hello, everyone. This is Kathy Kirk, founder of Applied Spirituality, and I have a special guest for us today, David Nagel. He's agreed to teach us a little bit of what he knows and teaches so well. David Nagel is the president of Life Is Now, Inc., a multi-million dollar global corporation dedicated to teaching entrepreneurs how to use the power of their minds to rapidly create quantum leaps in both business and personal arenas. David is known as the Million Dollar Income Acceleration Coach, and through his signature, Experience the Reality of Success live seminar and its high-level year-long mastermind programs, he masterfully guides individual entrepreneurs to create million-dollar enterprises. Having mentored and shared the stage for many years with the much-celebrated Bob Proctor, David is now one of the world's foremost business strategists and teachers of universal law and wealth consciousness. So we are very honored and privileged to have you with us today, David. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I have some questions for you, and the first of which would be, how useful is coaching and why? Why?
Well, I think that not only is coaching useful, I think that it's essential. If a person wants to go from a place of wherever they are to, you know, ultimately where they want to end up, one of the things that I cover in my events is that when you start to learn new information, or even if you just get a new idea, you know, you want to make a change in your life, you want to make a change in your business, that you have to change your environment to support that. You know, we're programmed. Our thinking is programmed very much like the hard drive of a computer. And because it's programmed, we typically think the same thoughts over and over and over again. And I share with people that it's not so much about what we think, but how we're thinking about what we think. In other words, there is a foundational set of truths or values or beliefs that we use to evaluate everything in our life. And if those things aren't really based in truth, but some opinion that somebody gave us, regardless of how true it may seem, we keep getting the same results over and over again. And, you know, we spend 24 hours a day inside of ourselves, dealing with our problems, dealing with challenges that we have, trying to construct and live this thing that we call our life. So if we want different results, we need different information. And what a coach does is it allows us to take problems, challenges, and ideas to someone that thinks from a different perspective, that can see things that we can't see, that can help us clear up confusion in our minds, they also have different skill sets, they have different talents than we generally have, or at least they have them in a more developed state. So they help us make more sound decisions about where we're going and help us conceptualize, you know, ideas that we may have from a different viewpoint. Because, you know, very often, like Napoleon Hill said in Think and Grow Rich, that opportunity usually comes in a disguised form, at least when we first see it. It appears to be unfortunate. It appears to be a setback, it appears to be something that we don't want in our life, and yet it's the very thing that's the catalyst to drive us forward. But if we can't see it, and really the way that we see is we see through our perception, so our perception's being created and controlled by our belief system. If we can't see the value in something, we not only can't we take action on it, but even if we did take action on it, we don't know what to do with it. Because we're thinking from our perception, from our perspective, from how we have viewed and experienced life up to the point that we're currently at. So when you bring a coach in, when you bring a mentor in to help you, they're usually miles ahead of where we are, and they allow us to see a completely different viewpoint. Therefore, we can make decisions from a different place that are much more sound for our life. And ultimately, you know, if we follow a coach's direction, you know, we'll get to where it is that we want to go. Now, I think that when you have a good coach in your life, you can get there much quicker than if you try to do it on your own. And that's because even if you have every book that was ever written on the thing that you want to do, you still view it from where you are in your own personal growth. Think about when you read a book today or you read a book 10 years ago, if you pick the same book up, you'll see things in it you didn't see there before. And it's not because those things weren't there before. It's because you've grown. So you can see things that were right there in front of you many years before, but you couldn't see them then. You can see them now. So when you have a coach, they can see those things now where you can't. And not only can they see them, they can help you see them, which allows you to make different decisions.
How does somebody realize that they need a coach?
I think that we realize, here's the unfortunate way most people realize that they need a coach, that they've tried to do something over and over again and they're not getting the result that they want. And very often they see other people getting the result. And they come to the determination that they must be doing something wrong. And, you know, somebody else knows how to do it different. So whether it's a coach, a teacher, a mentor, a friend, somebody in their life knows how to do something, and they realize that they need help. And I think that that is really the key. When a person can say, I need help, I can't do this on my own. And what's unfortunate, though, is that we've created a value in society of doing everything on our own, a self-worth value. And it's really unfortunate because we really can't do anything on our own. We have to do it by ourselves, but we can't do it alone.
You know, there's also the perception that coaching is for somebody else. You know, like it seems that coaching is, in my mind, becoming rapidly the next generation of quote-unquote therapy. But it's for the masses. It's not just for the people who can afford it anymore. It's for everybody. But there's just sort of a hurdle for the ordinary person to, like, oh, my gosh, I could do that, and that would actually help me, and I would, you know, get somewhere quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the way you put it. I never really heard it put that way, the new therapy. You know, in the 60s and the 70s, therapy was a really big thing. It was almost kind of, it almost had a fad quality to it. And I think from a good way, because I think people were very confused about how to manage their lives. And the thing about therapy is that that's pretty much what it does. It helps us make some sense out of things that didn't make sense in our lives or in our past, you know, when we were kids, mm-hmm. growing up, and then how to manage them in our current life. But here's a difference that I see with coaching, though. Coaching not only does that to some extent, but it also teaches you how to build a new life. There's a whole big piece about self-responsibility and new action in coaching, where in therapy, it was really about somewhat self-responsibility. A lot of the responsibility and blame still lied in other people. It was just kind of how to manage it. So this takes the management of your problems in your own life to a place of transformation. That's how I view it.
I also think that coaching teaches people how to think. I don't think we're ever taught, you know, critical thinking in school or anything like that, or how to actually manage your emotion what is that teaching you? What is that telling you? Now, how do I think about that, and how do I use that productively? None of that. But I do think that psychology was sort of the study of psychology in the 60s and 70s was the evolution of the consciousness. You know, we had to sort of do that part first before we could get to this part that we're doing now and placing the wisdom back within the individual.
I agree. I absolutely agree with you. It does teach us how to think, and that's the whole idea, because everything in the universe has already been prepared for us, and the only thing that keeps us from it is the way that we think. And you're so right about that. I mean, we are not taught how to think as children. And you know, you get a you say that to a grown adult, an intelligent adult, that you simply don't know how to think, and you get a very perplexed look in return. And I remember the first time that I heard that, I thought, yeah, that's kind of crazy. I mean, there's one thing I do know how to think. And, you know, activity in the brain is not necessarily thinking. And you have to have, you know, I mean, if we think about this, I mean, logically, when you think, there has to be some premise of truth in which you think from. Otherwise, you know, you're dealing with just everything is false. So if it's like if I try to give you directions, if I don't tell you where you are, there's no way you could end up going where you want to go, because you're coming from an unknown place. So if we don't create a premise of truth inside our own thought patterns, there's no way we can end up in the right place, because at some point we have to say, obviously what I believe to be true is not true, and I need to replace that.
Right. But don't you agree that really up until very, very recently, there really wasn't an opening for a ground premise of truth? The truth was so nebulous. It was, you know, lodged within what I call human mind. You know, it was lodged within religious dogma. It was lodged within patriotic dogma. You know, they were principles created by man, but they weren't like universal principles that are foundational to every living thing, not just humans, but every living thing. And they weren't considered operating principles for humans for some reason, you know, or they just weren't considered valid.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I totally agree with you. And I think that the reason for that is because primarily all of the world was in survival mode.
Yeah.
And it's only recently that part of our population is stepping out of survival mode, and thriving and success is being made available for all human beings, not just a very elite few, you know. When you're in survival mode, there's really no reason to have to think truth. We have to think thoughts that keep us surviving.
You know, oddly, though, for me, David, I don't know about you, you're listening to your story, and we haven't recorded your story for my listeners, but when I was absolutely in survival mode was when I asked the basic question, what's the truth? That's when it came to me to ask that question. It wasn't when I was fat and happy. It was
right,
when,
exactly.
You know, and I think, I don't know, I'm suggesting that maybe that's when you were going, wait a minute, what is going on here and how does this work, when you finally asked the question.
Yeah, that's, I totally agree with you. And I think that the reason is because we have the ability to go to a place where we can do something with it. If you were to go back a couple of hundred years, you know, if people tried to ask questions of truth, they were persecuted and in many cases executed for it.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't really permitted. And even if they did, there wasn't a whole lot that they could do with it once they got it, you know, because they were suppressed by other people. Today, there are societies that can, you know, surmount that suppression, and we can actually do something with it. And we could do something with it to change the world, really.
Yeah. Well, I think this is just the big gong. There's something, I don't know, cosmically that's gone off, because there is a definite awakening happening. I've been doing this work for 30 years, and I can tell you that 30 years ago there was no listen for this. You know, you were just a group. You know, you were a hippie, or you were, I don't know what you were, but was sit down and shut up, you know. But the time has come, and there is a listen to it, and I think that it's the evolution of the consciousness of mankind, where the power is no longer external to us. It's now coming home, and there people are actually looking, you know, as all these external edifices fall and fail everybody, government and medical care and education and all the quote-unquote experts, you know, just don't have the answers, or the authorities that they thought were authorities failed them, they begin to take up their own power, and that's happening globally, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. We're going to a great place.
So How did you first know that you needed to change something in your own life, and how did you personally go about it?
Well, I think that's a really great question. How did I know that I needed to change something?
Right.
I think that I hit my own bottom at a certain point in my life, because I don't think I would have known that I needed to change something until that happened, because I thought I was pretty much a victim, you know? And I thought that everybody else needed to change something in order for me to get better. So it wasn't until I got to the point where I felt in my mind that I had tried everything to bring about a different result and nothing happened, and what I had not done was accept responsibility for where I was.
Right.
So when I started doing that, that's when I really woke up that I needed to make a change.
You know, I remember the first time I realized that I was complicit in my own downfall. It was like in the wee hours of the morning, and it just came to me like an absolute truth that zoomed in and settled into every cell, and it made me throw up. I just was like, oh, my God, I was dancing the waltz with them. I was participating in it. So that moment of truth is pretty, it's a pretty big cosmic goose upside the head.
Yeah, it really is.
So how did you go about your change then?
Well, the first step that I made was when I realized that I needed to get out of a very specific situation. And the situation was that I had created more responsibility in my life than I had the ability to fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was primarily financial. And I looked around and I said, well, why can't I fulfill this? And the logical answer was, well, you quit high school, so you didn't finish school, you didn't go on to college, you don't have a skill, you don't have the ability to get a better job, to earn the money, to actually get yourself out of this situation. So it seemed like the logical answer would be, well, you have to go to school. Well, here's the very interesting situation that I placed myself in. I was married. I had two children. We were not living in a good area, so there was really no going down from where we were living unless it was being homeless. And I was working 6.5 days a week, two jobs, all the overtime that they would give me in order to not be able to pay the bills that I currently had. So I'm thinking, all right, well, huh?
Was this in Chicago?
It was in Chicago, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I was thinking to myself, how do I get out of this situation? Well, there was always a part of me that knew that, you know, there has to be a way. I just didn't know what it was. And a little voice, after being very, very frustrated and basically kind of having an emotional breakdown one night, said, change your attitude.
Hmm.
And I thought, I've never really thought about that before, but I've been hearing it all my life.
Right.
And if I was going to change my attitude, what would I actually change it to? So I was going through this process where I was looking for other people in my life who had demonstrated that they came from where I came from, yet they had a different outcome. And what was the difference between them and I? And I found this gentleman who was actually the guy that owned the company that I was working for. And I said, okay, I don't even know what an attitude is, but if I was to look at this guy and say, what is his attitude? What would I come up with? And I came up with three things. And they were that he must, and actually these were the differences I saw between him and myself. I hated what I did, and I hated where I worked. I thought, he must love what he does and love where he works. He must do every job to the best of his ability because he had built a $500 million company. And what I did notice about him, other than that, was that he treated everybody with total respect. And I thought to myself, I don't do that. I'm angry at just about everybody. And I work to go home, not to do the job the right way. And I certainly don't love what I do. So I decided I was going to change those three things for 12 months and see if it made any difference whatsoever. So I figured I'm starting at the beginning, you know, back where what the third grade teacher basically told me to do. And in 1 month, everything in my life changed. I went from $20,000 a year with overtime working 6.5 days a week and two jobs to making $62,000 a year working one job and nowhere near the amount of overtime. And
but how did you change your attitude? I mean, you know, when you're one way for a long time, angry and, you know, frustrated and, you know, kicking the dog and whatever, blaming everybody else, how did you, like, catch yourself in those moments and say, oh, I got to do this differently? How did you?
Well, it was a conscious choice from the get-go, right? It was actually acting the part just like an actor or an actress would.
Good.
And then deciding that's who I was going to be.
A decision.
Yeah, it was a decision. It was a decision. And don't get me wrong, there was a whole other side of my thinking that was saying, listen, David, you haven't stuck to anything that you've ever said you were going to do in your life. Why would you do it with this?
Right.
But at that point, there was nothing else to do. It was either that or continue living a life that was totally miserable.
Didn't it feel like you really, at that point, had no choice? I mean, when my turnaround came about, it was I had no choice, that the direction that my intuition was telling me, that the shifts I needed to make, I had to do. I mean, it was just an all-out do this, or there was no other choice. I had to do this.
Yeah, I agree. That's exactly how it felt to me, that there was no other choice.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of knew exactly where I had to go and what I had to do, but, you know, I bumbled along the way, of course, but the direction was certainly clear.
Yeah.
I'm curious how your wife took to this when, you know, when one part of a relationship shifts, like she married the guy who was angry, or maybe she married the guy who she saw the beauty of, and then you just emerged. I'm not sure which, but I'm curious about her response to your decision.
Well, I wasn't really angry when we got married. I wasn't in a place where I thought life was terrible. You know, I mean, I didn't start getting angry until I was creating all this responsibility and then woke up one day and realized I couldn't fulfill it, and
right.
I was stuck. That's what was making me angry.
So she got the real David back. She was getting the real David back.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, she was 100%, you know, supportive of it. I mean, it was, you know, it was great. I don't think I could have made the changes, nor could she have made the changes that she needed to make had we supported each other.
Has she moved in the consciousness stream with you as well? I mean, she... I think a lot of my clients are making changes in a relationship solo. You know, the partner isn't necessarily at the point of waking up and doing things differently. So I'm kind of curious. I'm not being prying, but just curious how you navigated that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, she teaches the same thing that I teach. You know, she just, we've always been on that path together.
Great. Beautiful.
I do think, though, that it does create problems within relationships if you have one partner that doesn't want to grow.
That's true. I mean, it's like you're doing a waltz together in some sort of sick fashion, and one of you decides it's time to tango, you know.
That's right.
So the other one is either going to have to learn to tango or new choices are going to be made, that's for sure. would you... be able to describe to my clients your internal process for shifting a limiting belief?
Yes. So it's different than it used to be, right? And here's only just preface this by saying why it's different. Because I think when a person first starts wanting to change beliefs, the biggest problem that they come up against is the actual resistance of letting go of everything that supports that belief system.
Right.
I don't have that resistance anymore. If something shows up, I just let it go and make the change. But years ago, it was very difficult because I didn't know that there were things that I was resisting changing that actually supported that belief.
Right.
So I fought against it a lot. Now, if something shows up, what I do is I become aware of it. I recognize that it needs to be changed. I recognize what it needs to be changed to and the supporting actions that need to take place to integrate it into my behavior. And I just do that immediately. So there's no resistance around changing it or letting something go or, you know, any of that stuff.
Do you use props to remind you that you're shifting things like sticky notes and billboards and things like okay, that's right, I'm changing this. I have to remember I'm going to change this, or this is my new thought pattern now. Or do you use those sorts of things?
I used to use them all the time. Mm-hmm. I used to have stuff around me constantly, and I recommend to my students that they do the same thing,
right,
because your mind wants to go right back to where it was.
Right.
So I am a big proponent of doing that. I'll tell people, when you come up with a new belief, you're going to make a new agreement to support that. You put that everywhere that you so you can see it, and you can do that on a consistent basis. Absolutely.
When you were talking about the resistance, I call those the ancillary beliefs. You know, it's like you believed something so long ago, and then you built a whole matrix, a big knot of beliefs around that one. So when you decide to change the one, then all the other little ancillary ones come up. You know, so I remember reaching one. At a certain point in my evolution, and I actually felt that my ego collapsed. I didn't know where I was or who I was for a while, you know, because I wasn't believing that anymore. And then you have to kind of go clean up the lint, you know, and dust those away. But it's an interesting process, the internal process of shifting. Could you address that a little bit, the emotional roller coaster of what that feels like when you're letting false things go and reaching for your good?
Yeah, it almost feels like you're dying in a way, like you're losing part of yourself, because I think we identify ourselves with those belief systems early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most difficult part about changing them is the not knowing the result of the new belief. It requires a measure of faith for a person to do that, because you got to realize they're getting something from the old belief. They're either getting love or appreciation or security. They're getting something to identify with that old belief. And when you start to change it, there's a period of time where you're not getting that. So it's almost like a person who's addicted to something. You go through a withdrawal symptom, you know, and it's not comfortable. It really doesn't feel good. So if you recognize that that's part of the process, and you put things in your life that can support you, people, coaches, friends, that give true support now. I'm not just, you know, because you got to be careful who's going to support you in a new belief system. There are people in your life that don't want you to change because it makes them very uncomfortable when you do change. But if you put those things in your life, you can make the change rather quickly and get through the emotional process. And one of the things that I suggest that people do is that they journal during this change.
Yep.
Because I don't – pardon me?
Amen.
Yeah, I don't think that it's – in my opinion, it's not good to suppress the feelings but express them. To get in touch with them, to know what they are, to know what they're about, write them down, let it out, however you need to let it out that's constructive for yourself. But I have found that journaling is a very good way to do that.
I like journaling, too, because when you think you're going through something that you've already been through before, you can go back and see where you were and that you really, truly have made incredible progress. You're just doing, like, remnants of something. You're not starting from square one all over again. And it's sort of a process that you can track your progress, because you do make progress every turn, every step of the way. It's forward. So, anyway, but we're running out of time here. My last question is, would you be able to describe how you uncover a blind spot when you can't see the forest for the trees?
Yeah, absolutely. When I know that when I am getting a result in my life that I don't want, that is repeating itself. Anybody could get a result from day to day that, you know, it's kind of arbitrary. But when you're getting one that's repeating itself over and over again, you know that there's something that you're not seeing. So at that point, what I'll do is I'll stop and I'll take a look at what it is that's actually causing that. What my thinking around it is. Where is that thinking coming from? Is there something that I'm attached to? what is the benefit, the hidden benefit that I'm actually getting from this problem? And then I begin to go in, and as those things start to come to the surface, then I go in and I start making those changes.
How much time, like when you're working in your process, are you focusing on what is desired until the point where you feel like you're tangled up somewhere, and then you yank your consciousness back to focus on perhaps there's a blind spot, or sort of what? How do you work with that in your head? I think it's a natural process, but I'm always curious about other people's process.
Yeah, I think for me it's become a pretty natural process to do it. I'm very open to change. So I think where a lot of people struggle is they're resistant to it. And I'm just at the point in my life where I'm not resistant to it. I want to make changes that are going to be better for me, better for my life, and keep me moving in the direction to fulfill the purpose that I'm here for.
Right.
So I know where to start looking immediately if something's not working out right. I pay very close attention to, how am I causing this? How am I creating it? And that's what every experience in my life. I will step aside. The first thing I do is step aside and say, isn't this interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I choosing to have this experience?
Right.
And if it's, sometimes it's one experience and then there's nothing else with it. But sometimes it's an experience that happens over and over again and it just has a different face. And when
right.
that happens, then you got to go inside and really start doing the work.
Right. The common denominator is me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time here, and I can't thank you enough. I could go on with a zillion more questions, but I'm so grateful to you for being so generous with your time and telling us what your processes are and what you think about coaching. And I just admire your work, and I appreciate what you've done for us today. So thank you so much, David Nagel, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.